moved in slow motion between the taps and the glasses, as if he were not pouring beers but handling radioactive isotopes. This fine fellow addressed Clint.
Guinness, son? Tasty on a night like this.
Make it a bud. The current Dubliner's tune was the Auld Triangle. Clint knew it and sort of liked it, in spite of himself. There was a romance to the song that was nothing like his experience of prison, but it got you, those voices gathering. Someone, he thought, ought to add another verse, though. The warden, the screw, and the lag all got turns. Where was the shrink? He was just about to take his beer to a dark corner when a finger tapped him on the shoulder. Clint? 16. What did it was the hug. Frank's daughter didn't just hug him when they were reunited. She dug her girl's hands into his upper arms so that he could feel her fingernails through his shirt. Everything that had happened, everything he had done, had made it clear that he needed to do something, anything, about himself, but that hug had tipped the dominoes. The last time he had seen her awake, he had almost ripped her favorite shirt off her body. His daughter loved him anyway. He didn't deserve it, but he wanted to. The anger management program was 3 days a week. At the first meeting, it was just Frank and the therapist in the basement of the dueling VFW. Her name was Viswanathan. She wore large round spectacles and was so young-looking, Frank figured she didn't remember cassette tapes. She asked why he was there.
Because I scare my kid and I scare myself. I also trashed my marriage, but that's just a side effect.
The therapist took notes as he explained his feelings and compulsions. It came more easily than Frank would have guessed, sort of like expressing pus from an infected wound. In a lot of ways, it was like talking about another person, because that pissed-off dog catcher didn't feel like him. That pissed-off dog catcher was someone who showed up and took control when Frank didn't like what was happening, when he just couldn't deal. He told her about putting animals in cages. He kept coming back to that.
My friend, said Dr. Viswanathan, this 26-year-old girl with glasses the color of Kool-Aid, have you ever heard of a drug called Zoloft?
Are you patronizing me?
Frank wanted to get himself together and not be fucked with. The therapist shook her head and smiled.
No, I'm being jaunty, and you're being brave.
She introduced him to a psychopharmacologist, and the psychopharmacologist wrote Frank a prescription. He took the prescribed dosage without feeling especially different and continued to go to the meetings. Word got around, and more men began to appear, filling half the chairs in the basement of the VFW.
They said they wanted to make a change. They said they wanted to get their shit together. They said they wanted to stop being so fucking angry all the time.
No amount of therapy or Big Pharma happy pills could change the fact that Frank's marriage was kaput. He had broken Elaine's trust too many times, not to mention the kitchen wall. But maybe that part was okay. He discovered he didn't actually like her that much. The best thing was to let her go. He gave her full custody and told her he was grateful for his 2 weekends a month with their daughter. In time, if things went well, it would be more. To his daughter, he said, I've been thinking about a dog. 17. How are you doing? Frank asked Clint as the Dubliners played and sang. Frank was on his way to Thanksgiving in Virginia with his former in-laws. The Zoloft and the meetings helped him control his temper, but in-laws were still in-laws, only more so when their daughter had divorced you. He'd stopped in at O'Byrne's to postpone his execution for a half hour.
I'm hanging in there. Clint rubbed his eyes. Need to lose some weight, but yeah, hanging in there.
They took seats at a booth in a dark corner. Frank said,
You're drinking in an Irish dive on Thanksgiving. Is that your idea of hanging in there?
I didn't say I was great. Besides, you're here too.
Frank thought, what the hell, and just said it.
I'm glad we didn't kill each other.
Clint raised his glass.
I'll drink to that.
They toasted, Clint didn't feel any anger toward Frank. Anger wasn't something he felt toward anyone. What he felt was great disappointment in himself. He had not expected to save his family only to lose them. It was not his idea of a happy ending. It was his idea of an American shit show. He and Geary talked about their children. Frank's girl was in love with some kid in Ohio. He was a little worried he might be a grandfather at 45, but he was playing it cool. Clint said that his son was awfully quiet these days, probably couldn't wait to blow town, go to college, see what the world was like beyond coal country. "And your wife?" Clint waved to the bartender for another round. Frank shook his head. "Thanks, but not for me. Booze and Zoloft don't mix all that well. I should shove off. The outlaws are expecting me." He brightened. "Hey, why not come along? I'll introduce you to Elaine's folks. Gotta keep on their good side. They're my daughter's grandparents, after all. Visiting them is sort of like hell, but with slightly better food." Clint thanked him, but declined. Frank started to get up, then settled back. "Listen, that day at the tree..." "What about it?" "Do you remember when the church bells started ringing?" Clint said he would never forget. "The bells began when the women started to wake up." "Yeah," Frank said. "Right about then, I looked around for that crazy girl and saw she was gone. Angel, I think her name was." Clint smiled. "Angel Fitzroy. Any idea what became of her?" "None at all. She's not at Curly, I know that much." "Barry, the insurance guy? He told me he was pretty sure she killed Peters." Clint nodded. "He told me the same thing." "Yeah? What did you say?" "Good riddance to bad rubbish, that's what I said. Because Don Peters was the problem in a nuthell." He paused. "Shell, that's what I mean. Nutshell. My friend, I think you should go home." Clint said, "Good idea. Where is it?" 18. 2 months after what had become known as the Great Awakening, a Montana rancher saw a woman hitchhiking on Route 2, just east of Chinook, and pulled over. "Hop in, young lady," he said. "Where are you headed?"
"Not sure," she said. "Idaho to start with. Maybe out to California after that."
He offered his hand. "Ross Albright. Gotta spread 2 counties over. What's your name?"
"Angel Fitzroy."
Once she would have refused the shake, used an alias, and kept her hand on the knife she always stored in her coat pocket. Now there was no knife and no alias. She felt no need of either. "Nice name, Angel," he said, fetching third gear with a jerk. "I'm a Christian myself, born and born again."
"Good,"
Angel said, and without a trace of sarcasm. "Where are you from, Angel?"
"A little town called Dooley."
"That where you woke up?" Once Angel would have lied and said yes, because that was easier, and besides, lying came naturally to her. It was a real talent. Only this was her new life, and she had resolved to tell the truth to the best of her ability in spite of the complications.
"I was one of the few who never went to sleep," she said.
"Wow, you must have been lucky and strong."
"I was blessed," Angel said.
This was also the truth, at least as she understood it. "Just hearing you say so is a blessing," said the rancher, and with great feeling. "What's next, Angel, if you don't mind me asking? What are you going to do when you finally decide to nail your traveling shoes to the floor?" Angel looked out at the glorious mountains and the never-ending western sky. At last, she said,
"The right thing. That's what I'm going to do, Mr. Albright. The right thing."
He took his eyes off the road long enough to smile at her and said, "Amen, sister. Amen to that." 19. The women's correctional facility was fenced off and condemned, marked with signs warning against trespassers, and left to crumble while the government allocated funds to more pressing public works. The new fence was strong, and its base was embedded deep into the turf. It took the fox several weeks of digging, and all his reserves of patience to tunnel beneath it. Once he had accomplished this engineering feat, he trotted into the building through the massive hole in the wall and set about constructing his new den in a cell close by. He could detect the scent of his mistress there, faded but sweet and tangy. An emissary came from the rats.
"This is our castle," the rat said. "What are your intentions, fox?"
The fox appreciated how straightforward the rat was. He was a fox, but he was getting older. Perhaps it was time to quit with tricks and risks, find a mate, and stay close to his skulk.
"My intentions are humble, I assure you."
"And they are?"
pressed the rat.
"I hesitate to say aloud," the fox said. "It's a little embarrassing."
"Speak," said the rat.
"All right," the fox said.
He tipped his head shyly.
"I'll whisper it. Come up close to me, and I'll whisper it to you."
The rat came close. The fox could have bitten her head off. It was his talent. Each of God's creatures has at least one. But he didn't.
"I want to be at peace," he said.
The morning after Thanksgiving, Lila drives to the gravel turnaround on Balls Hill and parks. She pops Andy, bundled in his infant snowsuit, into a baby carrier. She starts to hike. Maybe they could put their Humpty Dumpty marriage back together, Lila muses. Maybe, if she wants him to, Clint could love her again. But does she want him to? There is a mark on Lila's soul. The name of the mark is Jeanette Sorley, and she does not know how to erase it. Or if she wants to. Andy makes small, amused noises as she walks. Her heart aches for Tiffany. An unfairness and a randomness knits into the fabric of everything, and it inspires as much awe in Lila as it does resentment. The icy woods creak and tick. When she gets to Truman Mayweather's trailer, it's frosted with snow. She gives it just a passing glance and moves on. Not far to go now. She emerges into the clearing. The amazing tree isn't there. Jeanette's grave is not there. There is nothing but winter grass and a haggard oak stripped of its leaves. The grass wavers. An orange shape flashes, vanishes, and the grass resettles. Her breath steams. The baby hums and expresses what sounds like a question. "Evie?" Lila moves around in a circle, searching. Woods, ground, grass, air, milky sunshine. But there's no one. "Evie, are you there?" She yearns for a signal, any kind of signal. A moth flutters from the branch of the old oak tree and settles on her hand.
A Conversation with Stephen King and Owen King.
Hi, I'm Stephen King.
And I'm Owen King.
And we're here to talk about our new audiobook, Sleeping Beauties.
The idea for Sleeping Beauties was pretty random. In our family, we do a lot of pitching of ideas to each other, not generally with the intention of making a novel out of them. I had the idea and I said, what about a story about the world where all the women have fallen asleep? And my dad said, that's an awesome idea. And I said, great, go write it. And he said, no, you have to write it. We went back and forth in that fashion for quite a while, but eventually we settled on writing it together.
For me, when Owen pitched that idea, I immediately started to think of all the ramifications that were possible. And I said, you know, we really ought to write this. Then Owen said to me, what if we did it as a limited TV series, like 9 or 10 episodes? And so we started to do a screenplay. We actually did a pilot episode.
Yeah, we did a second episode as well.
Owen just kind of said, whoa, wait, we got to do this as a book, right?
It was an exciting TV series, but I felt hemmed in terms of the characterizations and the one-hour spaces. I wanted to do more with the characters, and I felt like it should be a book before it was a show.
The women weren't singing the way that we wanted them to sing.
No, they weren't popping out.
So at that point, Owen said, we have to get some boots-on-the-ground type experience.
Probably 10% of the things that we learned made their way into the book, but knowing the other 90% made it possible for us to feel confident enough to write it. We did, in fact, tour a women's prison, Goffstown State?
Goffstown, yeah.
In New Hampshire?
Goffstown, New Hampshire.
We were fortunate enough to be allowed to take a tour. The warden took us around, and we saw the grounds and got a feeling for how the inmates lived and
what the routine was, too.
Exactly.
In terms of intake, and we saw what they called the soft room, where women who are agitated, who come in, they have to sit down. We saw the library. We saw some of the places where they work. To me, it energized the process. Owen likes to say now, when we read the book, it's hard for us to remember who wrote what. Because I collaborated before, and Peter Straub and I, when we did The Talisman in Black House, we started with a kind of Bible-type outline. And he wrote, and then I wrote. It was like playing tennis. But when Owen and I wrote, Owen proposed this idea where we would take the specific place where we were in the book, and I would write that particular sequence. But in the middle of it, I would leave a donut hole, an empty place, and then before he went on to the next part, you'd fill it.
Right, so you'd tell me what you wanted, or I would tell you what I wanted in that space. It's like, I think that Clint's going to do this right here. You mm-hmm. write that, and then you would write it. And that was to throw off anybody that was naughty enough to try to figure out who wrote what. But then ultimately, we rewrote each other quite a lot.
We went that way back and forth, and finally, we had a first draft. Then when we rewrote the book, Owen rewrote me, and I rewrote Owen. And the thing is, when we finished this process, we were still friends. We still got along. We were still taking each other's calls, which was a great thing. It's wonderful to be asked to collaborate with your son. It's like a terrific gift. But you only want to do it if the product that comes out at the end is something that's going to be worthy of both of you, and readers are going to say, wow, that's fantastic. It's like a unified effort. And I knew from the books that Owen had written that he was going to be able to do the job. What I didn't know was how good it was going to be.
I think it would have been a rewarding experience even if we didn't end up with something that was publishable, because we had such a good time, and we had this months-long conversation with each other and never argued about anything. You know, I can recall once or twice I would say, well, I want to have this happen, and he would say, oh, no, give it a shot. Or he would say the same thing to me, and it always worked out. I will read things back to myself out loud very quietly sometimes, just to hear how they play. But actually, when I was a child, my childhood job was reading books on tape for this guy.
That's right.
And I didn't mow the lawn, but I read you books on tape.
You did?
He would say, I want you to read The Watchers by Dean Koontz. Mm-hmm. I'd get my cassette recorder, 60 or 90 minute audio tapes, and I'd say, welcome to side one, tape one of The Watchers by Dean Koontz, and I would read that sucker until, you know, until the end of the side, and then I'd flip it over. I must have done, how many books do you think I did for you over the years?
Oh, man, you did probably 24, and that's a conservative thing. I can remember you did White Jazz by James Ellroy.
Oh, that one killed me because I totally didn't understand. I was like 12.
Yeah.
I did Ariel by Larry Block, I remember.
Yeah,
I did,
you did
Fellowship of the Ring.
You also did a book by Charles Williford, you know.
Oh, yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
It was a great experience, though. I'm very comfortable reading my writing out loud, and it's part of my writing process, and I wouldn't have gotten that if you hadn't hired me to do that for all those years.
We're both professional writers, and we've both done readings in public, so we're comfortable with that. But the thing about audio and reading those sections aloud that are troublesome sometimes for me is that oral reading is unforgiving. It's totally unforgiving. You can read a book with your eyes to yourself, and the novelist can get away with sloppy phrasing or sloppy prose. But when it's read aloud, you hear every flaw and every ding. So sometimes that's a good thing. But when a pro reader reads a book, I think it's one of the greatest experiences that you can have as a reader. It is bona fide reading. I love audiobooks. Owen read me War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy on CDs. Actually, I think he started on cassettes, and by the time
took me so long. It was, yeah,
it was CDs. I got my kids to read me books on tape because I thought it would be a broadening experience for them or a good experience. It was totally selfish. At that time, audiobooks had just begun. The first audiobook I ever listened to, the FAA, Reagan fired the air traffic controllers. And I was going back and forth to Pittsburgh. And on a flyer, just as an experiment, I got the cassettes of The Thornbirds by Colleen McCullough. And after that, I was just hooked on audiobooks. But at that time, you couldn't get a lot. And so the stuff that I couldn't get, I got my kids to read. But it was great. It worked.
Sleeping Beauties is set in Appalachia. So could be Southern Ohio, could be Kentucky, could be West Virginia. I think that Appalachia made a lot of sense for us as a setting because the book is very of the moment in a lot of the issues that it butts up against. And if you think about it, Appalachia is sort of at the heart of a lot of things that are happening in our country right now. It's a place that's been economically and environmentally ravaged, and the political system hasn't been able to help Appalachia. You know, there's this terrible epidemic of opioid addiction there. But at the same time, it's one of the most beautiful places in our nation. Mm-hmm. And there's this juxtaposition between how people are struggling there and how beautiful it is and how the natural world of Appalachia. It made a lot of sense for the book, which has a lot of environmental themes.
I've traveled in West Virginia and through Appalachia and through the Blue Ridge, and some of my favorite novelists are from that area. But also, you know, Owen's from upstate New York. I'm from Maine. We've both written about our areas, and I think we wanted to find neutral ground.
Maine had suffered enough.
Yeah, Maine had suffered enough from
Stephen
King.
There's no question about that.
So it's time for West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, for those places to take their knocks.
Sleeping Beauties, a novel, was written by Stephen King and Owen King, and read by Marin Ireland. It was recorded by Noriko Okabe and Stephanie Ciccatiello at Simon & Schuster in New York. Editing and post-production by Steven Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producers were Tiffany Ferrari and Elliot Rombach. Sleeping Beauties was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Sleeping Beauties, a novel, is available in print from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Dead Zone, by Stephen King, read by James Franco, and Double Feature, a novel, by Owen King, read by Holter Graham.